Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are not just analyzing a topic, or we're going to try to transport you. I want you to close your eyes for a second, unless you're driving. Please don't do that. But mentally, I want you to travel with us.
We're going to a very specific coordinate in space and time.
Picture this. It is January, the early 1970s. You are in Finland, but not, you know, the modern tech-savvy Helsinki of today. We're talking about the gritty post-war industrial towns and the really remote outposts near the Arctic Circle.
To really get the stories we're covering today, you have to understand the atmosphere, the physical sensation of the place.
Right. Let's talk about the darkness first. If you're listening to this in, say, California or Florida, you have no real concept of this. We are talking about a darkness that feels heavy. In the winter, in towns like Tornio, which is right on the Swedish border, the sun is basically a rumor.
It's a twilight existence. The sun might, you know, drag itself above the horizon for a couple of hours, maybe from 11:00 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., and it casts this long, blue, kind of bruised shadow across the snow.
And then it's gone.
And then it's gone. By 2:00 in the afternoon, it is pitch black again.
And the cold. We weren't talking about put on a sweater cold. We're talking about 40 degrees below zero. The kind of cold that it freezes the moisture in your nose instantly. Mm-hmm. The kind of cold where metal actually burns your skin if you touch it.
Yeah, and then you have the complete inverse in the summer, the midnight sun, where the light just refuses to leave. You can literally read a newspaper outside at 3 a.m.
It's a land of psychological extremes. Your circadian rhythms are just completely smashed.
Totally. And in the middle of this intense, stark, frozen landscape, you have these industrial hubs like Tampere. So you have to imagine these red brick factories, smokestacks, the smell of paper mills, which is a very distinct sulfur smell, and a population that is just tough, resilient, and still recovering from the wars of the mid-century.
It's a very complex environment.
And dropped right into the middle of this linguistic and cultural labyrinth are young Americans.
Okay, let's set the stage for our subjects today. We are looking at a stack of journals, memoirs, and retrospective accounts from missionaries who served in Finland between 1972 and 1974.
And we really need to clarify who these people are. They're kids. They are 19, maybe 20 years old. Most of them have never lived away from home, let alone in a country that borders the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War.
And they are thrust into this environment where they don't speak the language. And we are going to get into why Finnish is, well, a nightmare for English speakers in a minute. And they're dealing with profound isolation. They're living in apartments that are often barely heated, dealing with the pressure of their duties, and just trying to figure out who they are.
I think it's important to state our mission for this deep dive right up front, because yes, the source material is religious. These are missionary journals, but we are not here to, you know, preach a sermon.
Not at all.
No. We're here to look at the anthropology of this experience. We're exploring human resilience. We are looking at that universal, terrifying feeling of imposter syndrome when you are standing in a suit supposed to be an expert and you realize you have absolutely no idea what is going on.
We're going to talk about the ripple effects of tiny actions, the chaos theory of human connection, how a letter written in Idaho in 1953 changes the demographic landscape of a town in Finland 20 years later. It's wild.
And we have some just incredible stories to parse through. We have memoirs from David Strait, Scott Lundberg, Mike Nyborg, and others. And these aren't just dry daily logs. These are their drama.
Seriously, we are going to talk about a guy who was literally on the verge of becoming a rock star. I'm talking opening for the Beach Boys and why he just walked away from it.
Which is a fascinating case study in opportunity cost and really value hierarchies. Mm-hmm. What do you value most?
We have the Tale of the Broken Spoke, which sounds like a fable, but is actually a brutal lesson in physics and procrastination. Mm-hmm. That it ends with a guy flying over his handlebars.
And a story about a practice teaching session that was meant to be a drill, a role play, that accidentally turned into this huge life-changing event.
So buckle up, put on your parka. We are heading to the deep end of the Baltic.
Let's dive in.
I want to start with a feeling that I think everyone listening has felt at some point. It's that shock of arrival, that moment where the excitement wears off and the reality hits you like a freight train.
Or in David Strait's case, a literal train.
Exactly. This comes from David Strait's memoir, The Enabling Power of the Atonement. Let's set the scene for David. He's a young guy. He's been called to Finland. He spends 2 months in a language training center in the U.S.
Right, which back in the 1970s was known as the LTM. And right. The method was, well, it was intense memorization. You memorize phrases. You memorize vocabulary lists. You know, where is the library? The cat is on the table, that kind of thing.
So David leaves the training center feeling pretty good. He's got his flashcards down. He thinks, okay, I can do this. I know Finnish.
Which is the classic Dunning-Kruger effect, isn't it? He knows just enough to think he's competent, but not nearly enough to realize how incompetent he actually is.
He flies to Helsinki. He gets his assignment to go to Tampere, which is this industrial city in Åland. He gets on a train with another missionary. And this is where the bubble bursts.
The train wreck.
He's sitting there, and outside the compartment, there are these local teenagers. And in the 70s, on European trains, you could sometimes, you know, hang out between the cars or right by the doors. These kids are rattling the door, shouting, laughing.
And this is the ultimate litmus test. Because classroom language is sterile, it's slow, it's perfectly enunciated. Teenagers, they speak in slang, they slur words, they speak at a million miles an hour.
David leans in. He's ready to translate.
Yeah.
He's ready to show off his 2 months of hard work. And he realizes.
Nothing.
White noise.
Just a wall of sound.
He describes it as a physical shock. He says, I realized then I was in trouble. I didn't understand anything.
Yeah.
Not a word. It wasn't that he missed a noun here or a verb there. He couldn't even find the breaks between the words.
And we should probably pause here to explain why this happened. Because if you go to France with 2 months of French, you might catch a word like croissant or bonjour. Finnish is, it's a whole different animal.
Wait, so what makes it so different?
Well, Finnish is a Finno-Ugric language. It is not related to the Indo-European family, so it's not related to Swedish or German or Russian or English. It's related to, like, Estonian and Hungarian. Grammatically, it is a fortress.
Okay, give us an example, something that makes it so hard for an English speaker.
Okay, think about prepositions. In English, we have these small separate words. In, on, from, to. In Finnish, those don't exist as separate words. They are case endings attached to the noun. And there are 15 noun cases. 15. So the word for house is talo. But in the house is talossa. From the house is talosta. Into the house is taloon. On the house is talolla. And if you modify the noun with an adjective, the adjective has to change too. So in the big house involves changing both big and house to match the case.
So when David Strait is listening to these kids on the train, his brain is searching for an in or a the. But those words just aren't there. The sounds are all morphed into the ends of other words.
Exactly. The very structure of the thought is alien to him. And that realization that he has spent 2 months studying and is functionally illiterate and deaf is just devastating.
It shatters that illusion of competence immediately. But the universe wasn't done with David yet. He gets to Tampere, he's reeling from the language shock, and then administrative chaos strikes.
Ah, the change letter.
Explain what this is for someone who doesn't know the organizational structure.
So in this missionary structure, you always work in pairs. It's called a companionship.
Mm.
And there is a very strict hierarchy. You have the junior companion and the senior companion.
And the senior companion is basically the boss.
Correct. The senior companion is the mentor. He handles the money, he plans the schedule, he does the talking at the door, he navigates the bus routes. And usually, you don't become a senior companion until you've been in the country for maybe 9-10 months. You have to learn how to survive first.
So David has been in Finland for about a month. He's still a greenie. He's still in shock from the train ride. And apparently, there's a shortage of missionaries. A big group went home. The new group is delayed.
It's a staffing crisis, a logistical bottleneck.
So David goes to the post office. He gets a letter. And it says, Elder Strait, you are now a senior companion.
I mean, this is the equivalent of taking a first-year medical student who has only ever practiced on plastic dummies, walking him into the OR, handing him a scalpel, and saying, okay, you're lead surgeon on this bypass. Good luck.
He actually just tosses the letter aside. He thinks it's a form letter, a mistake. He thinks, this must be a mass mailing. This can't be for me. Denial is the first stage of grief, right?
He cannot cognitively accept that the organization would be reckless enough to put him in charge of anything, let alone another person.
But then he goes to an English class that night, and the other missionaries are buzzing. Did you see the changes? Hey, you're a senior now. And the reality just sets in. He describes a feeling of absolute cold panic.
In his memoir, he says, I listened to people talking on the bus and couldn't understand a word. We went to our appointment, and even in a gospel conversation, I couldn't understand a word. And now he's responsible for another human being, his new junior companion, who knows even less than he does.
And here is where we see that very human fight or flight response. He admits something incredibly honest in his memoir. He says he was tempted to just hide.
the bunker mentality.
He thought, if my new companion and I just stay in the apartment, if we just don't go out, surely the leadership will realize they made a mistake and they'll demote me back to junior companion.
Which is such a relatable instinct. When the water is too deep, you just want to tread water until someone throws you a line. He wanted to wait out the error.
But he doesn't. And this is the pivot point of his story. He has a moment of clarity or duty or faith, whatever you want to call it. He thinks, I was not sent to Finland to waste the Lord's time.
That sense of mission overrides the terror. He decides to go out, even though he knows he is going to fail.
And this leads to one of the most interesting phenomena in these sources. He calls it the enabling power. I sort of call it intuition over vocabulary.
Let's unpack this, because this enters the realm of, like, flow states or something beyond just technical skill.
So, paint the picture. David is now the senior companion. He's knocking on doors. He feels like a complete and utter fraud. Finally, a door opens. A man invites them in. They sit down.
Now, normally, the senior companion leads the discussion. He's the one who's supposed to talk. But David can't speak the language.
The host asks a question. David is sitting there, just sweating. He understands zero words, nothing. He doesn't know if the guy asked about God or the weather or politics.
He is standing on the edge of a social cliff, and the wind is blowing.
But then, he says a thought enters his mind, crystal clear, not in Finnish, but the concept. He just knows what he is supposed to say. He opens his mouth and he recites a phrase he had memorized, maybe the only phrase that fit the rhythm of that moment.
And it works?
It was the exact answer the man needed. The conversation continued. The man was satisfied.
This is fascinating. I mean, from a psychological perspective, you could talk about nonverbal cues and microexpressions. It's possible that David, stripped of his ability to process language, became hyper-attuned to the emotional tone of the room. He read the intent, not the syntax.
Strait views it as spiritual intervention. He calls it operating at the edge of the light.
That is a beautiful phrase, the edge of the light. It suggests that we are capable of functioning just beyond our competency if the intent is pure. When you can't rely on your technical skills, you have to rely on your humanity, your intuition.
It's about communication being so much more than just grammar and vocabulary. And speaking of the struggle to survive in this environment, we have to talk about the physical reality. It wasn't just hard socially, it was hard physically.
Right, and for that, we need to bring in Margaret Bridges. She served around the same time, and her memoir, which she calls The Immersion Experience, it gives us the domestic details that often get left out of the official histories.
She talks about the housing. Now, in the U.S., in the 70s, pretty much everyone had a refrigerator. It was a standard appliance.
In 1970s Finland, in these older apartment blocks, refrigerators were not guaranteed at all. They were a luxury.
So what did they do? I mean, with milk and butter, they improvised. She describes keeping their butter, milk, and cheese in a cupboard. But not just any cupboard, a cupboard built against the outside wall of the apartment.
Because the insulation was so poor, or maybe non-existent, that the cupboard acted as a walk-in cooler. The freezing temperature from outside just penetrated the wall.
It highlights the gritty reality of it all. You're waking up in a freezing room, grabbing your milk from a freezing cupboard, and then going out into the freezing street. It's just relentless.
And Margaret also touches on the language aspect from a different angle. She talks about chit-chat Finnish.
I loved this term. It's so descriptive.
She was living with companions who were native Finns. They didn't speak a word of English, so she couldn't retreat into English at the end of the day. She was immersed 24/7.
So she learned to survive. She could buy bread at the store. She could ask for directions. She could, you know, gossip. She sounded fluent to the casual listener.
But ask her to explain the grammar rules. Ask her to diagram a sentence. She had no chance.
It's the difference between street smarts and book smarts applied to language, right? It's pure survival mode.
And sometimes survival mode leads to the most unexpected successes.
Which brings us to a story that is honestly one of the funniest and most touching in this entire collection.
The practice session.
This is from Scott Lundberg's account, Tampere, 1972. This reads like a sitcom plot. It really does. So the mission president, the big boss in Helsinki, is worried. He looks at the numbers and he sees that most missionaries are only teaching the first two lessons to people. Nobody is getting to the advanced theology.
Right. Discussions 3 through 7, the, you know, the deep doctrine. And he's worried the missionaries are forgetting the material because they never get to use it. They're getting rusty.
So he issues a mandate, a decree. He says, you must practice these advanced lessons daily. He wants to use their lunch hour to stay sharp.
It's a drill. It's a purely technical exercise. Keep your sword sharp, that kind of thing.
So Scott and his companion are in Tampere. They have to follow the rule, but they don't want to just you know, talk to each other. So they find a target.
And the word target is appropriate because they did not view this person as a legitimate investigator, not at all.
Right. They choose an elderly widow, Mummo Laudanen.
Mummo being the affectionate Finnish term for grandma.
She was a nice lady. She had let them in before, but they explicitly say in the source they didn't consider her a viable contact. She was just nice.
She was the path of least resistance, a safe space to practice their lines.
So they go to her house. They explain, hey, we need to practice our lessons. Is it okay if we do it here? And she says, sure.
And a ritual begins.
Every single day at lunch, they show up. She serves them Mayhew, which is this strong berry juice concentrate in cookies. And they set up their flannel board.
Oh, the flannel board. We have to explain this for the Gen Z listeners. Before PowerPoint, before iPads, there was the flannel board. It's a board covered in felt. And you had little paper cutouts with sandpaper on the back that would stick to the felt.
So you could be like, here's a picture of a temple. Here's a picture of a prophet. It's peak 70s technology.
It absolutely is. So they are there moving their little felt figures, rattling off the memorized script for discussion number 3, then number 4. They go through all 7 discussions. Then they start over and do them again.
They did the entire cycle twice in 2 weeks.
And their mentality the whole time is purely, we are obeying the mission president, we are getting our practice hours in, and hey, the juice is good.
They're checking a box.
That's all it is.
So the 2 weeks end, they pack up the flannel board, they stand up to leave, probably thinking, okay, that's done, back to the real work of finding people to convert.
Yeah.
And then Mummo Laudanen stops them.
This is the twist that they did not see coming. At all.
She looks at them and she asks very sincerely, what do I need to do to be baptized?
And according to Lindbergh's memoir, they were just stunned.
He said they looked at each other sheepishly. They were completely shocked.
Think about the irony here. They were treating this as a rehearsal. They were actors reading lines in a dressing room. But she was the audience and she didn't know it was a rehearsal. She was listening to the message. She was taking it to heart.
It's a profound lesson in looking beyond the mark. They were so focused on the rule, we must practice, that they completely missed the human being sitting in front of them who was having this genuine spiritual experience.
It creates a fascinating disconnect between intent and impact. Their intent was maintenance. Their intent was, in a way, selfish, let's keep our skills up. But the impact was conversion.
It really forces you to ask, how often do we do things just to get them done, not realizing that the act itself holds weight for the person who's watching?
It proves that the message can be more powerful than the messenger's awareness. You can be an imperfect, distracted messenger, and the signal can still get through.
And sometimes the messenger is just the final runner in a relay race that has been going on for decades. And this brings us to what I'm calling the long game.
This is the Mike Nyberg story, and if the last story was about accidental success, this one is about calculated multi-generational persistence.
This one gave me chills, actually. So Mike Nyberg arrives in Finland in 1973. He is assigned to Tampere, but this isn't a random assignment.
No, not at all. Tampere is his mother's hometown.
Mike is half Finnish. His mother had married an American soldier or a missionary, the records vary a bit, and moved to Idaho. But Mike has a very specific mission within his mission.
He wants to baptize his own grandmother, Mummo Hilja Itkonen.
Now, if this were a Hollywood movie, the scene would be, Mike shows up, the handsome grandson from America. He gives this rousing, heartfelt speech. The grandmother weeps and converts instantly because of his charisma.
But reality is much more complex and, frankly, much more beautiful because of the, well, the logistics involved.
Mike visits her immediately. He pulls out a tract of pamphlet and asks if they can discuss it over dinner. And eventually, in October 1973, he does baptize her. On the surface, it looks like a classic missionary success story.
But when you read Nyborg's memoir, you see the massive iceberg that's sitting just beneath the waterline.
This wasn't about Mike arriving in 1973. This whole story started in 1953.
Right. His mother moved to Idaho. And for 20 years, 2 decades, she wrote letters home.
We have to emphasize this. This is before email, before FaceTime. These are physical, handwritten letters, international postage, every single week. For 20 years.
And it wasn't just the letters. She built a network. Her best friend, a woman named Sisser Nieminen, stayed in Finland and kept the faith. And back in Idaho, Mike's parents hosted missionaries at their ranch. And every time a missionary was sent to Finland, the mother would say, if you go to Tampere, please go see my mother.
So for 20 years, missionaries had been knocking on Hilja Itkonen's door. They had been having tea. They had been planting seeds, one conversation at a time.
So when Mike showed up, He wasn't breaking new ground. He was harvesting a field that had been plowed, watered, and tended by his mother, by her friend, and by dozens of nameless missionaries for a quarter of a century.
It just deconstructs the myth of the overnight success. We love to look at the moment of victory, the baptism, the sale, the book deal, and credit the person standing there. But we miss the decades of invisible grind that made it possible.
It's the tree analogy. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. Mike's mother planted the tree. Mike just got to show up and sit in the shade.
It really makes you wonder, what are we doing right now? What letters are we writing? What habits are we building that won't pay off for us, but might pay off for our kids or grandkids 20 years from now?
That is the very definition of legacy.
But not every story in this deep dive has a happy ending, at least not in the traditional sense. We need to talk about the Merikainen family in Tornio.
This is, I think, the heaviest part of our discussion. It touches on tragedy, death, and something that borders on the supernatural.
Let's introduce the father, Mr. Merikainen. By all accounts, a truly remarkable man. He was orphaned young, he was a war veteran, and remember, the Winter War in Finland was unbelievably brutal. He becomes a successful businessman in Lapland.
He's a survivor, but he's also a seeker. He's looking for something spiritual, something more.
He finds a copy of the Book of Mormon, he reads it, he is genuinely interested. But we are in Tornio remote, frozen Tornio, and this is a common theme in the source material.
Mm-hmm.
The missionaries are inconsistent.
Right, they get transferred. Or the weather is too bad. Or they just, for whatever reason, stop coming.
So Mr. Merikainen is left hanging. He has the book, but no guidance.
Huh.
So, being a man of action, he decides to go to the source. He books a trip to Israel. He wants to walk where Jesus walked.
He's looking for a spiritual connection that he couldn't seem to find in the frozen north.
And while he is there, in Jerusalem in 1972, tragedy strikes. He has a massive heart attack and dies.
He never got baptized. He never joined the church. From the outside, this looks like a failure, a missed connection, the end of the line.
The family is devastated. The mother is a widow. The daughters are grieving. It feels like the end of the story.
But then comes January 1973.
It is dark. It is freezing cold. Two missionaries, Elder Rasmussen and Elder Bounds, are in Tornio. It is 9:30 at night.
Which, we should note, is very late to be knocking on doors. Socially, that is really pushing the envelope.
They ring the doorbell at the Merikainen house. Inside, the eldest daughter hears the bell. She looks out. She sees these two Americans standing in the snow.
Mm.
And she's annoyed. She is grieving. She wants to turn them away.
She is about to just ignore the door, go back to what she was doing.
And this is the moment that defies easy explanation. She claims she hears a voice.
Her father's voice.
The deceased father. And he tells her distinctly, let them in.
Now, we can analyze this through different lenses. You can view it as a literal spiritual intervention from the other side, or you could view it psychologically, her grief, her knowledge of her father's unfinished spiritual search manifesting as an internal command.
But the result is the same. She opens the door.
And because she opens the door, the missionaries come in and they find a family that is ready. They are primed.
They start teaching. And usually conversion is a slow process. Lots of questions, lots of hesitation. But when they ask the daughter if she would be baptized if the message is true, she replies instantly, Kultekai!
Of course.
The missionaries were stunned. They realized they had found what they call a golden family. But the insight here is that the family was golden, not because of the missionaries, but because of the father.
The father who died before he could see it. His failure to connect with the missionaries during his life actually set the stage for his family's acceptance after his death. His search primed them for the message.
And the ripple effect of this is insane. We talk about the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
This is it in action.
The family converts, and suddenly, the tiny branch in Tornio starts exploding. They grow so big they have to move their meetings. And where do they go?
The family owned a movie theater. So they start holding church meetings in the club room behind the theater.
But the ripple goes even further. We have to talk about the hairdresser.
Oh, this is the ultimate long game statistic. So one of the Merikainen daughters who gets baptized eventually needs a haircut. She goes to a local salon.
She finds a hairdresser she likes and she sticks with her.
She goes to her for 26 years.
Let's just do the math on that. A haircut every 6 weeks. That's roughly 8 times a year. Times 26 years. That is over 200 haircuts.
And at every haircut, for 26 years, she talks a little bit about her faith. Just casual conversation. Here's what we did at church. Here's what I believe.
She doesn't push. She doesn't preach. She just shares.
And finally, after 26 years, while sitting in the chair getting her hair done, the hairdresser looks at her in the mirror and says, I am ready.
Jiads, thank you for your patience with me.
I mean, just let that sink in. We live in a world where if a text message takes 5 minutes to get a reply, we get anxious. We want hacks for everything. Mm-hmm. Speed learning, speed dating. She waited through 26 years of haircuts.
It speaks to a completely different perception of time. It's an agricultural view of people. You plant, you water, you wait. You don't stand there and scream at the seed to grow faster.
It's the total antithesis of our modern optimize everything culture.
And speaking of culture clashes and values, we absolutely have to talk about Jake,
the rock star of Tornio.
This story feels like it belongs in a VH1 Behind the Music episode. It really does.
So it's the summer of 1973. Jake is a young guy. He's a recent convert to the church. But before that, he was and still is a musician. And not just, you know, a garage band hobbyist.
The source describes him as the complete package. Songwriter, vocalist, frontman. His band is dominating national competitions in Finland. They're on the rise. They're the next big thing.
And then he gets the call. The dream call. The call that every kid with a guitar dreams about.
The promoter contacts them. A major international act is touring Finland, and they want Jake's band to be the opening act.
And who is the headliner?
The Beach Boys.
Okay, we need to contextualize this. I think younger listeners might think, oh, the Beach Boys, the Kokomo guys, that's oldies music. No. In 1973, the Beach Boys were titans.
Pet Sounds had revolutionized music. Good Vibrations was a global anthem. They were arguably the biggest American band on the planet at that time. Opening for them wasn't just a gig, it was a career maker. It was the difference between being a local hero and an international star.
Jake is ecstatic. The band spends months rehearsing. They're polishing the set list. They are ready to take over the world.
And then the second call comes, the logistics call. Here are the dates. The concert is on a Sunday.
And the room goes cold.
For Jake, as a new convert, Sunday had taken on a new, non-negotiable meaning. It was the Sabbath. It was a day of worship, a day of covenant. It was not a work day.
This is the crossroads. This is the hero's journey moment. Fame versus faith, career versus conviction.
And I want to play devil's advocate here for a second. It would have been so easy to rationalize this. It's just one Sunday. I can share my talent, which is a gift from God, right?
Yeah.
Think of the influence I could have as a famous religious rock star.
The rationalizations write themselves as the opportunity cost theory. The cost of saying no is massive.
Right.
Fame, money, travel, everything that comes with it.
But according to the source, Jake didn't agonize. He didn't hold a town hall meeting. He didn't poll his friends.
Who just said no.
He turned down the Beach Boys.
He prioritized his religious observance over the biggest break of his entire life.
That is a staggering hierarchy of values. It yeah. suggests that his internal chord was already written. He didn't have to make the decision in the moment because he had already made it when he converted. He was just executing the code he'd already written for his life.
And what's the aftermath? Well, he doesn't become an international rock star. He stays in Finland. He raises a family in the faith.
But years later, his son, Jari, is interviewed. And he says that specific decision, that no to the Beach Boys, was the foundational legend of their family. He says it was the reason he and his brothers all chose to serve missions later on.
It established the family identity. Oh. We are the kind of people who put God before the Beach Boys. That was their brand.
It creates a legacy of integrity. But it raises a really tough question for the listener. What is your Beach Boys moment? What is the thing you want so badly that you would compromise your values for it? Or, conversely, what is the thing you would give it all up for?
It's easy to have values when the stakes are low. It's easy to keep the Sabbath when you don't have a concert offer. The test is when that offer is on the table. And sometimes the test of our values isn't a big dramatic moment like a rock concert. Sometimes it's just a bicycle spoke.
Which brings us to our last story, the tale of the broken spoke.
This is Carrie Barney's story from 1974. And this is the perfect metaphor to wrap up the narrative side of things because it is so visceral and so, so relatable.
Carrie is in Tornio. He has a bicycle, a blue steed, he calls it, single speed, old school ringer bell.
If you've ever ridden a cheap, heavy bike, you know this machine. It's a tank. It's functional, but not pretty.
He's riding the countryside and his companion looks over and says, "Hey, Elder, you're missing a spoke on your front wheel."
Now, be honest, if someone told you that, what would you do?
I'd ignore it 100%. The wheel has, what, 32 spokes? One missing spoke seems statistically insignificant.
Exactly. And that's what Carrie does. He says, "Yeah, I'll get it fixed later." He keeps riding. The wheel still turns. It seems fine.
But physics is relentless. A few days later, he hits a bump. Pop. A second spoke breaks.
And crucially, it breaks on the opposite side of the wheel.
Now we have a tension imbalance. The wheel loses its trueness. It starts to wobble.
Kiri describes it as a shimmy, especially on the downhills.
Mm-hmm.
The handlebars start to shake a little bit in his hands.
And again, he adapts. He normalizes the wobble. He thinks, okay, I'll just tighten the nuts later. I'm busy. It's not a big deal.
This is such a human trait. We are masters of compensating for dysfunction. My knee hurts, I'll just limp. My car makes a weird noise, I'll just turn up the radio.
We normalize the brokenness until we completely forget that it's broken.
But the laws of physics don't forget. A third spoke pops. And this time, he's riding on a cobblestone street in Tornio.
The unforgiving cobblestones, the ultimate stress test.
The loose spoke isn't just missing now, it dangles. It gets caught on the fork of the bike. It tangles in the remaining spokes. The front wheel locks instantly.
From 15 miles an hour to zero in a fraction of a second.
Kiri goes flying over the handlebars. He hits the pavement. Hard.
Catastrophic failure.
He's sitting on the curb. His pants are ripped. He's got road rash all down his arm. He's got a headache. And he looks at his bike. The front wheel looks like a taco. It is completely destroyed.
And in that moment, sitting on the curb, he has the realization. This wasn't an accident. This was an accumulation of neglect.
He uses this as a perfect metaphor for life maintenance. He says human nature is to ignore tiny inadequacies.
I'll fix that relationship later. I'll apologize for that thing I said later. I'll start studying later. Yeah. All those little things.
We think we can get away with it because the wheel still turns. It still gets us from A to B. But the cobblestones of life, the stress tests, the unexpected challenges, they will eventually come. And if the structural integrity isn't there, the wheel locks.
The wobble is the warning. The crash is the consequence.
And it connects back to everything we've discussed today. David Strait didn't ignore the language barrier. He leaned into his intuition. Mike Nyborg's mother didn't ignore the connection to her homeland. She maintained it with letters for 20 years.
They kept their spokes tight. They did the maintenance.
And the guys who practiced with the widow? They were tightening their spokes, even if they didn't realize why they were doing it.
Exactly. They were doing the maintenance, and it paid off in a way they didn't expect at all.
So as we pull all these threads together, let's try to synthesize this. We've gone from the macro generations of family history and international borders to the micro, a single rusty bicycle spoke.
I think the big takeaway for the learner, for our listener, is that success in these stories wasn't really about perfection.
Right. David Strait was a bad missionary on paper. He didn't know the language. He felt like a fraud, but he showed up.
Scott Lundberg and his companion were just checking a box. They were, you could say, unspiritual in their intent with that widow, but they showed up.
Kiri Barney literally crashed his bike. He failed the maintenance test, but he learned the lesson from the crash.
It wasn't about being perfect. It was about persistence. It was about the enabling power of just being there, of knocking on the door, of writing the letter, of speaking the broken phrase.
It's the idea that if you put yourself in the position to be used, you will be used, often in ways you can't predict or control.
And being willing to look foolish, that's a huge part of it. Whether it's speaking a language you butcher, or asking a widow if you can practice on her, or turning down a rock concert that everyone else thinks you're crazy to refuse, you have to be willing to do the thing that makes no sense to the outside observer.
So here is our provocative thought for you to mull over as you go about your week. I want to go back to the hairdresser.
The 26-year timeline.
We live in a world of instant gratification. We want the download now. We want the delivery today.
I want you to ask yourself, are you capable of a 26-year project?
Are you willing to have the same quiet conversation, do the same small act of kindness for 26 years to see a result? Or do you give up after the third try because it's not working?
And looking at your own life, your own wheel, is there a wobble?
What is the missing spoke you are ignoring right now? The small thing, the health checkup, the phone call to a parent, the apology you owe your spouse,
yeah,
that you keep telling yourself you'll fix when you have time.
Because eventually you will hit the cobblestones, and you want that wheel to hold.
Fix the spoke.
Fix the spoke.
That's it for this deep dive into the Finnish mission field of the 1970s. A story of cold winters, warm hearts, and the incredible resilience of the human spirit.
Thanks for traveling with us.
We'll see you next time.